All right, we're in Visual Studio World again, Building 41, with a couple architects from Light Switch. Please introduce yourself.
Well, my name's John Rivard, and I'm architect on Light Switch product, which we are working on getting out to Beta 1 very shortly here.
Mm-hmm.
And
Steve Anderson, distinguished engineer, working on Light Switch, amongst other things, in Visual Studio. And we're pretty excited. We just got to announce Light Switch, which is... we're calling the simplest way to build business applications on the desktop and the cloud.
Okay.
So I've actually worked, give you a little bit about my background.
Yes.
I've worked in business applications for, about 25 years, I guess. My history is actually with the Dynamics and Business Solutions Group within Microsoft, and so we've been at that for a long time. And I've written a lot of business logic over the years, a lot of systems over the years, and... switched into the world of tools in the business solution space and found out that we were going to be building a tool for constructing business applications here in Visual Studio and said, all right, let's join up and work on that. And it's an exciting project because one of the challenges that I faced over the years of working on large business systems is you have a suite of technologies which continually change over the years, right? But the problem you face is that how do you configure that set of technologies to get an end-to-end solution in place?
Mm-hmm.
What's the database access technology I'm going to use? What's the UI technology I'm going to use? How am I going to do marshalling over the wire? How am I going to do reporting? How am I going to do this, that, and the other thing? So there's a whole suite of problems you have to solve.
Mm-hmm.
And typically, you need them configured in one specific way to be able to ship the system. And finding that particular way is a lot of work. So in all the groups that I've worked in, we've actually had a separation between the systems guys and the applications guys. And the system guys basically work with the application guys to figure out how do we get an end-to-end tool that will solve all the problems using the best technologies to get the best apps out. And that's exactly what it is that we wanted to do with Light Switch, is to say, look, we've got a lot of challenging technologies. Now the platform matrix has actually gotten a lot harder.
Mm.
We're talking now about Azure and cloud computing, web computing, a lot of security issues that have arisen, new user interface technologies, questions about where Silverlight fits in. A lot of great, excellent technology there, but how does Silverlight integrate in with... data access.
Mm-hmm.
I want to do data access in Silverlight. Can I do Entity Framework, for example, talking to the middle tier from Silverlight? There are actually some challenges there. Do I want to hand the target market for Kitty Hawk, which is probably this small business developer? So, you know, what we want is somebody who's very much like actually the apps people that I've worked with in the past. These folks are really good at the domain. They're really good at meeting customer needs, right? What they want is a tool that basically lets them solve the problems that they have without having it get in their way. That's really what it boils down to.
And that kind of makes us the systems guys.
Yes.
Right? Because if they're the ops guys and they are the domain experts for their business and for what they need to do, they need to translate that problem into a tool that can just sort of solve the business problem and not have to build some elaborate infrastructure to go get it done. Obviously, there are systems guys out there that have that as a domain expertise, and they might twiddle around with this tool, but it might also be that they want to do something very particular. So we're really focusing at that apps crowd, that they just want to build a productivity app, data entry, whatever, utility apps, mm-hmm. all kinds of stuff that they have to go build, and we want to make that easy to do.
Absolutely. I mean, no need to write code. Essentially.
Well, you can write lots of code in Light Switch.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a non-developer, non-code kind of product. This is a product for people who don't want to build the systems architecture. So you don't have to write low-level code. You don't have to write plumbing. But you're going to write business logic.
Sure.
Which means that you can write an awful lot of your app probably without writing any code at all.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the demos that you're going to see...
We have seen them on Channel 9. That's why I had mentioned that.
Yeah, you can do a huge amount of stuff without writing any code.
Mm-hmm.
But the goal was to say, well, and this was the goal in the systems that I've written in the past, the runtimes I've written for Dynamics NAV or Dynamics AX or Dynamics GP or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Actually, years ago, early 90s, Microsoft had a business application called Microsoft Profit, which was written in Visual Basic, and it was the largest Visual Basic application in the world at the time. And so I was one of the first guinea pigs who got to use Visual Basic to write a really large business application and see what really worked well about that and what really didn't work well about that. And it created some interesting challenges. But, why don't we switch gears?
Okay.
And let's talk a little bit about how we thought about the architecture for this application,
yes.
How we think about building it. And it's basically what I want to do is describe an architectural pattern that I call model-centric architecture. Some people call it model-driven development, but I don't, because I think it suggests sometimes it says model-driven development. It's not just development. We're talking about runtime. Models are central to the way the whole application works over its life cycle, both from the time that you design the thing until the time that it's finally retired. So let's do that.
Okay. So you want to get onto the
we'll
board?
We'll go up on the board. Steve, you can get started with that, that section.
Perfect. What I'm going to do is slowly up here.
So if you do spend some time coming to study the architecture of pretty much every major large business application you've ever seen, and also most of the small ones that are commercial applications, you'll see that the companies have invested in a tool that's uses what I'd call model-centric architecture. And some of these terms over the last few years have become more common amongst general developers. Things like domain-specific languages and modeling constructs and things like this, but they've been used for many years before they were popular. Writing an architecture like this is actually a little bit more expensive than it is to just sit down with your compiler, write the code, and off you go. And so, but if you want to, well, I'll get into it, and some of the reasons why this is useful will make sense. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about a few different elements here. Let's start with building blocks. The question is what are the core constructs with which you want to define your application? And so in the case of light switch and pretty much any of these 4GL type tools, light switch not being 4GL, of course, but you saw this sort of thing. We have building blocks, which include entity and screen and query, and it goes on into lots of other elements. But the point of it is this is the vocabulary for our modeling language. And you'll see actually some other very large and small things that use models as well. I think probably the biggest one that people are familiar with is SQL. Etc., right? Back in the early days, VB created a set of a vocabulary that was new, unique on Windows. It said, we're going to have a very few things. And it had four of them. Control, property, event, and form. And of course, in time, form just became a control. It wasn't at first, but eventually it did. So what they did is they said, we're going to take all this complexity that sits inside the context of Windows, and we're going to boil it down to a few key abstractions, which basically transform the way people look at this sort of system. And now everybody has this in every system that exists. So that's their entire set. Our set includes this. Let's continue on from here, though. Once I have one of these, I, of course, will start to create specific instances of these. So I might define an entity, which is a customer, and then I might have a customer entry screen, and I might have customers by state as a query, and on and on it goes, right?
Sure.
Those are specific instances. The question is what are those instances, and of course what they are collectively, is they're a model. And models get stored somewhere. And then I need some means to create the model. And so that brings me to a designer. And this is really the way people have encountered the product, Lightspeed, LightSwitch, so far.
I like Lightspeed.
Lightspeed.
All right.
Well, yeah, it's...
To infinity and beyond.
To infinity and beyond. Yeah. Your computer has... Anyway. This is the way that people are encountering the product right now, is basically through these designers. And so we have an entity designer. Code can actually be a designer, too. But for the most part, people think of designers as being something other than that. And you have a runtime. And so the runtime is the thing that animates the model. It's the thing that gives the semantics and the behavior to the model. It's really easy to see that when we're talking about in the SQL space, because here we're talking about, for example, the query processor. We're talking about the stuff that does the updates, the all the different elements of how the runtime processes the DML and the DDL that you hand it. So that's the runtime. And here, as it turns out, we said we have to write a runtime, but we would like to write the least amount of code as we possibly can, and we'd like to use the best practice code that we can mine from anywhere else within the company. So, for example, we're using Entity Framework and Data Services, which is also known as Astoria or IDEO.NET Data Services. Basically, it's the OData protocol stack. And we're using Silverlight, and we're using RIA services for some things. But all of this is an internal set of capabilities that are used to basically make our entities or our screens or our queries or our things like that run. The thing to notice is that the terms that the programmer uses to develop the system is up here. They're not writing things in terms of a set of basically creating a new class in EF and annotating it with a base class and and whatnot. In fact, they're not even using the Entity Framework Entity Designer. What they're using is this thing up here. And this model then will use this stuff to make the system run. So the question is at what point are you going to start to see some code? Well, there's really two classes of code a person can encounter. One is basically these building, I'll just call them building block classes. And so let's say that I had my customer and I wanted to write a little bit of logic on the customer. Where do I write the code? Well, at that point, up till now, by the way, there has actually been no code that somebody's had to write. And so when you go and you look at this LightSwitch app, there's been, in the demos that you've seen and a lot of the screenshots that have been done, typically there's not a lot of code that's been written. The only time you actually need to write code is when you want to actually generate this class. So in this case, it's at this point that I need a customer class. And I might end up with other sorts of classes that handle screens and as it turns out, there's a second class of thing here, though, and I'll just call this... You could call this runtime control or runtime services. But the idea is that you've got this rich runtime. How do you tell it to do stuff for you? So the way you tell it to do stuff is you give this thing an API. And, of course, in the case of SQL, the API happens to be, for example, the SQL client library. It's the way that you can handle some SQL text and have it execute some stuff for you. But there really isn't that much in the way of the SQL runtime in the way of APIs. Most of it's done through this textual format, which is really all part of their modeling language. Now, when you look at most of the, a lot of the applications that people are building today, this is inverted. A lot of the conversations I have with people, they start here. this is where the conversation begins. What's the API for how I create X? What's the API for how I call Y? The thing you need to notice about LightSwitch is it's the other way around here. You go to these when you need the services. This is the core construct. The model is first, not the code. And so this is the API. And then the last piece that I'll throw in here is extensibility. Because this is a bit of a self-contained universe, right? And one of the problems that, going back to the 4GL world, because some people have categorized this as solving problems in a way reminiscent of 4GLs, they tended to be closed universes. They didn't really have a way of, if the tool didn't do something, you waited for the next release. Well, that's absolutely not the way LightSwitch is. LightSwitch is a full Visual Studio product. It runs inside of the Visual Studio shell. And in fact, you can open one of these projects inside of Visual Studio Pro, add new projects that would allow you to, for example, do extensibility stuff. Mm-hmm. So what kind of extensibility might you want to do? Well, you might be doing new data sources. You might want to create controls. You might want to do themes for the user interface. Anything you would want to throw in into that list?
Yeah, we have a number of things that we thought would be high importance for V1. So one of the things, in addition to that, controls and themes are about customizing the UI. Another one that we've actually demoed in the keynotes were just creating whole new shells. And so somebody can actually skin the entire outside of the shell that controls creating and running the screens. So there's shells. Another one is data types. Mm. We have in the box a couple what we call business data types. There's not a good category for them if you're a CLR guy. Well, what is it, a type? And it's a type up here. It's a type up in the modeling language. It's sure. Not a type at the CLR level. So we have things like money, and we have things like email address, phone number that are in the product. Mm-hmm. But from extensibility, you can create new ones. You could create social security number, or you could create something that's unique to your business domain and plug it into the product. And having created that, it winds its way through the rest of the system for validation, for data display, for you can put custom controls that are associated with it.
Okay. So one question I would have immediately, since you guys went the CLR route and the kind of the what that means, at least what we've advertised it as meaning for the past 10 years, is that in some sense I should be able to write a computation library in F# that
right.
does very interesting things over large data sets that the person who builds the LightSwitch app doesn't have to worry about but could plug into their model.
Right.
Is that possible?
Yeah, you can plug it in. In as much as we're using just normal .NET languages, VB and C#, when you go to write your code, mm-hmm. then you could use any other language that fits into that space. So if you wrote that library and it's really cool, you just reference that library from one of the projects where you get to write code and you just call into it. So that's all the benefits of actually having kind of a wider ecosystem in .NET.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
And so that characteristic gets at the point that the designer is actually a Visual Studio experience. Let's switch gears here then. This is basically to give a feel for the environment, and there's probably a couple of points to make up front. First of all, we talk about this thing being built using, for example, core technologies.
Mm-hmm.
And what this does is it gives us all of the strength that these technologies provide in terms of offering features and performance and whatnot. What that doesn't mean, though, is that somebody who walks into LightSwitch suddenly has to become an entity framework or data services guru. In fact, they can't, in large part. That's not the point. The point is, in fact, that we want to provide a lot more simplicity in the experience. So let me give you one example of this, and then I'll ask John to elaborate on this a little bit. One of the examples that I ran into, I said I wrote a really large VB app way back when.
Mm-hmm.
So we're forever writing business logic that causes UIs to get updated. And one of the nice innovations that happened over time is this data binding thing. But frankly, it was actually the smaller and less interesting problem that needed to be solved. The bigger problem is stuff like, let's say that I have a screen and I have these three values data bound, and I want to just show this guy read only, right? The question is how do I make sure that this guy is always up to date on the screen? Well, what I need to know then is I need to know every time any one of these guys changed. So what would I do? Well, I'd create an event handler for this, an event handler for this, an event handler for this. And then, if the calculation was complicated enough, I'd probably have some function that I called that redid the calculation. If it wasn't complicated enough, or if I'm an average VB developer from the days back when I remember reading some pretty hellacious VB code, a lot of these guys would just copy and paste this into every single event handler. Doggone it. And so the problem was, the tool did not encourage best practices. People wrote terrible, terrible code all the time. And so one of the questions that we asked ourselves as we began to work on LightSwitch is, what are some of the idioms that we can put in place into the environment? Look, we're mortal. We're not going to be able to avoid lousy code in every situation. But what are some things we can put into place that take some of these common sorts of things that people need to do and avoid those sorts of problems? And one of them we came up with is calculated properties. Mm-hmm. So how do those work?
Cool.
Yeah, I'll talk about that. So let's take the same scenario that you did. So let's say, basically, let's go back to kind of the original concepts. Is when we invent some new concept in LightSwitch to solve a problem, typically it goes back to the modeling space to say, okay, how does that concept show up in the world? And we have these top-level building blocks like entity and screen. Ends up that property is also a building block. It's a smaller one, and it's modeled. And when we're modeling an entity, typically we're modeling the storage properties. So if I have some entity here that I call foo, and it has properties A, B, and C that exist in storage, that's all great. So the idea was, how do I get D on there, which is the sum of those things? So we, in that particular case, thought, well, it'd be best to do it, you know, right in place on that entity. This is a rule of the entity. So let's make a computed property. It's something you can design in the designer and say, I'm going to have D, and, you know, let's say these are all ints. So D is going to be of type int, and you design that. And all you got to do is tell us a couple things about D, and we're off to go, which is write a little piece of code that says, you know, what is the function for D? Mm. And so you drop to code, and you'd see something like this, D underscore compute. And then we'll give you the signature. I'll do this one in C# just for example. Let's see, this is going to be ref int result. And you would just say result equals this dot A, you know, plus B plus C, right? And that's it. Now, this sounds really trivial, like, okay, so big deal, you're adding a couple of numbers. Mm. Well, the problem that Steve was just talking about is, when do I update that value? How do I know it hasn't changed? What's going on? And we didn't want you to have to go, you know, hook all the event handlers and say, okay, the same thing, you know, put a property changed event handler on C, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, it gets even crazier. What if this computation isn't on C, because we have a thing called navigation properties? What if C is another entity and it has its own properties? So it says something like this dot C dot you know, Q dot R, right? And it's just, it gets more and more complicated.
Sure.
Because now your dependency chain is actually deeper than just one level. So what we did is we took this on as a runtime problem. It's a modeling problem initially to say, how do I model the concept of a computed value? So we let you do that. Then it becomes a runtime problem to solve the issue of when it gets computed. So what we do, quite simply, is, first of all, we don't compute this value until somebody asks for it, right? It just sits there. And if somebody starts to ask for it, we go ahead and evaluate the expression. But what we do under the covers is, during evaluation, we know we're doing a computed property, so we'll pay attention to everything you touched along the way, and we'll go ahead and set up the listeners, in fact, to figure out if anything you touched changes. Mm. So under the covers, we can actually just set ourselves up something that would cause things to become dirty. So if B gets changed, we can just set B as dirty, and we can basically propagate that through the system, which now means that this D is dirty. Mm. And if any, we can send out the change listeners for D, and then if anybody wants to see the new D, we'll just go ahead and recompute it.
Sure.
So this makes it really easy to write simple business logic where this might be iterating over a list of things or anything complicated. Mm. We'll just keep track of it for you.
Cool. I mean, again, if somebody updates a value, I mean, you'd imagine that this isn't just a read-only kind of world. People
right.
are going to be updating people's telephone numbers.
Sure. There's lots of easy examples you'd see, like in a screen. Like you might want to have the title of the screen dynamically be the person's name or the company name, or you want to have a summary string that adds a couple things together, first name and last name. Mm. So there's lots of places here where just adding one of these is really trivial to do, and it's useful, you know, at those places in the application where you needed it.
Cool.
We don't persist this. Right now, this is actually a transient value. We can compute it on the client or on the server, so you can recompute it, but it doesn't become one of the storage values that we'd actually persist. We just compute it dynamically.
Interesting. I guess one of the things to point out, I mean, and to ask you guys about, I mean, and I know that when LightSwitch first came out, there was some feedback from the professional developer community that, you know, what are you guys doing, right? Mm-hmm. You're dumbing down. I mean, there's always going to be that kind of extreme thing, but you're trying to make it easy for people to understand and actually use a multi-tiered system, a three-tiered system.
Right.
Not about how, you know, complex programming semantics. So let's kind of remind people that
right.
when we're looking at
it. Well, again, so look at here. It's like there's, I think a way of framing this, the way Steve said before, is like there's the systems guys and the apps guys is a great way to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
The application itself, the computation of this expression in your business logic could be arbitrarily complicated. So it's not like we're dumbing that down. You need to calculate the tax code, and the tax code is complicated.
Yes.
So let's let that be your problem. The what you don't want to have to do is figure out, you know, when, you know, the state changed and I need to update the lookup field for what the current tax rate is. Well, we'll handle that for you.
Mm.
So you just write the expression and we'll go ahead and figure out when those things changed. And so it's really a nice division of labor, I think, to say let us be smart at what we can do and let you be really smart at what you can do.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I'd like to see some Niners play around with RX in this model as well and kind of have the reverse, kind of the event streaming model of mm-hmm. observer patterns and reactive programming,
right,
which
yes.
could work in this as well.
Right.
It's just a .NET library.
Right.
But you have to understand it. It's not going to be for the average office worker.
That's exactly right. And so the point of it is this notion brand new? Well, of course it's not. How many people actually want to create the dependency tracking system necessary to make this function reliably?
Mm-hmm.
Not very many people. Some people may use something like RX-style programming mm-hmm. in the context of their stuff, and they're pretty smart people, and they probably feel pretty good about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great. What we would like to do is extend those sorts of techniques to people who aren't very good at it.
Sure.
And mm-hmm. they get to write less code. Now, another thing is, and one of the things we were saying when we were first working on LightSwitch is we were saying we'd like to minimize the amount of code that people write to focus on the code that really only they could have written.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
There's lots of code that other people can write, but they're the ones who understand the domain, so let's focus their work on the domain. There's another interesting piece about this. You'll notice that he has a foo entity.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say it was an order entity, and this was the total or some such. The point of it is that the calculation is now on the entity. And so a best practice that anybody who's been around for any length of time understands is that you have actually a model that has your entities in it. For example, I've got a customer. And then I have a UI that binds to the entity, and changes to the entity cause the UI to update. Very basic pattern, right? Well, now we've actually not only said that the computation is done in one spot and we'll call it for you, we've also put it in the right spot. It's in the model. And the nice thing about the fact that it's in the model is that it doesn't matter what tier you're on. If you're on the client tier or you're on the service tier and you're using the customer entity, they'll both, at the right time, when you ask for this value D, they'll both compute it by using the same runtime system. Well, this gets me to an interesting point. What, there's a set of hard problems that Lightswitch worked on, stuff that we thought were particularly difficult and particularly important for simplifying the system. One of them is that, look, a best practice is, let's say I want to do a validator or a computed field. So we talked about computed fields. Didn't talk about validators, but I'm in a situation that before I save customer, I need to know that the thing is valid, so I call certain methods that make sure that the properties are valid or the entity as a whole is valid, etc. And I'll do that on the service tier before I do my save. I'll also do it on the client tier, though, because this is a safety thing. This is a rapid user feedback thing, right? Users want to know right away that it was bad. They don't want to wait until the whole form is done and they submit, right? Mm-hmm. But they've got exactly the same piece of logic that's running. Well, how does that work today? Well, in some of the systems that I've worked on, the way it works is I have the same code twice, or maybe I have a library that's shared, but definitely the invocation sequence is separate because these are two different tiers. So as it happens, our client is Silverlight, and our service is .NET. But the exact same assembly with exactly the same code containing the validator is shared on both tiers. And this is an example of a problem that we solved as we went to the Silverlight and the .NET teams and we said, look, gang, these folks want to write this stuff once, and they want to write it in one DLL. And some of them, when they first start using this system, mm-hmm. honestly, they don't necessarily always get the difference between client and service anyway. And so am I going to hand them this tool? They're maybe somebody who's trying to get used to programming, or they could be somebody who's a rocket scientist, right? Either one could use Lightswitch, but we're talking about the folks who aren't familiar with this. We want them to walk in, write a piece of code once, compile it once, get the errors once, and then deploy exactly the same DLL onto both tiers. I could get into the story about how much work that was, but suffice it to say that it was a lot of work, and we're really happy to have gotten it done because now nobody else has to deal with it when they're using Lightswitch.
But, I mean, that's actually a good thing to talk a little bit about because you guys, you know, you went through that, you thought through it, you solved the problem. I think that's interesting to talk about.
And in many of these cases, in many of these cases, what happened was we looked at a hard problem. And oftentimes you say, well, if I was a customer out in the field, how would I solve the problem? Oftentimes you have to work with what you have. Inside Microsoft, sometimes we can say, well, gosh, this is a hard problem. And if that other team would just do this, this, and this, mm-hmm. it would really make that problem easier. And oftentimes it's a problem that we're having, but it's other customers are having the same thing. So this one in particular, the .NET guys were aware of this. Other customers had asked for it. We came in with a big ask. And in .NET 4.0, they did some changes to the loader that would say, hey, you know, under these constrained situations, we can load up a Silverlight built assembly and execute it, and it will work. And we looked at that, and we said, yeah, those constraints are okay. It's good enough for us to write business logic. Let's go for it. And so so what ends up happening is when we build our project system out under the covers, we're actually building several different DLLs. You don't necessarily know which one we're building when you're writing code. But when you're writing entity code, you're writing common code, and we build that once, and it gets built as a Silverlight DLL that we get to publish to both tiers. I was really excited about getting that in because the developer experience otherwise, you know, was going to be a little frustrating for debugging that code and understanding it.
Exactly. I was just going to ask that about debugging. Debugging across tiers has always been a challenge.
Yeah, and in Silverlight, it's really not that hard, especially because, effectively, if you write that line of code one time, if you set a breakpoint on, you know, the decompute, it doesn't matter if it's getting computed right now on the client or the server, you'll hit the breakpoint. And you might be able to see from the call stack, I happen to be in the server, I happen to be on the client, but if your goal is to debug that function, you're going to hit it just once, and that'll be helpful.
Cool.
And wherever it runs. Yep, so...
Even in a virtual machine in Azure? It's located maybe in China in one moment, or...
we would love to make
Las
all...
Las Vegas in another?
We would love to make all of that work. That's high on our list of things to make work.
Right so, on.
But that's exactly the sort of... That's exactly the sort of the problem we want to be able to solve. And part of the reason why the model-centric architecture is interesting is we actually haven't made commitments in code that people see and touch. As soon as you have commitments in code that people see and touch, you have now have a permanent commitment. You can never change it because there's people who expect it to be that way, or you break them. Mm. So, for example, if we do find that we can get better Azure debugging, and by the way, it is a high priority, strong interest, we can suck that in to Lightswitch and make it super easy to use. And you don't have to change your project, you don't have to change your runtime, it just happens.
Sure.
Well, so John did briefly talk about the fact that there's this shared project. This is where entity code goes. And so if you get again to best practices, just what does a best practice architecture look like? Well, you are going to have three chunks of code. You're going to have stuff that only is relevant for the client. And the more you get into a situation where you have a strong entity model, you'll typically find that the client project has less and less to do. Client projects will typically involve WYSI UI effects, things like that. And in the context of Lightswitch, we're also hoping a lot of those are things that people will be able to do in BS Pro, because we have a very automatic, basically we have this automatic flow layout system.
That was an example of one of the hard problems, is how do you take this developer and say, hey, you know, you'll have decent looking UI when you're done, but you didn't have to sit and tweak the alignment of all the pieces on the screen and
sure.
spend a whole bunch of time laying out things, where so, your real goal was just the business logic and getting it done. So,
I should come back to that in a minute. So let me finish up on this thought then. The point of it is where's the right place for people to put code? Well, if you're an experienced developer, you'd have a pretty good idea of the right place to put code and how you should do it.
Mm-hmm.
You understand that there are things that are going to be shared logic. You might be able to actually share the DLL if you're doing Silverlight.net. Until we just released Dev 10, VS 10, 2010, you actually couldn't do that, but now you can. And we'll do it for you automatically. But there's another rather important piece of code, which is all of your what we call the update pipeline. And this is the logic that processes, okay, I made a bunch of changes on the client to these five entities, I packaged them up into a bundle, I shoveled them back over to the service. Now what do I do with them? What's the right way to handle the transaction cycle and the update cycle? And what can oftentimes happen, this is an example of a hard problem that we wanted to solve as well, is that you have individual business logic you want to write against each of the entities. For example, maybe what happens is I created an order, and the action that they took is that they wanted to post the order. Well, in the process of posting the order, they may end up doing something like creating a back order because mm-hmm. the inventory wasn't on hand. And because of that, they need to actually add new records, and then they need to update the order as well. Well, the question is every time I update the order, I need to revalidate. And that means I need to actually go back through the loop again and make sure that nothing that they did in that piece of business logic actually broke that entity. Now I'm creating new entities. Mm. Those have been added to my update context. I need to go through exactly that same cycle there. I need to run a validation loop against that. And that itself may trigger new inserts or deletes. And I need to do validation there to make sure that things didn't break. And oh, by the way, I have relationships, so I need to be sure that I do my cascaded deletes. But upon the cascaded deletes, I've got to be able to call the business logic that might be attached to it. This turns out to be quite a complicated piece of work to make sure that you get it right and that things loop back properly and they don't loop back too often. You call the validation code always at the right time, etc. So the design of this was a bit of work, but hopefully the effect is going to be you walk in, you say, I call some validators, I've got a piece of business logic that says upon update of this order, oh, it's posting, therefore I insert. I go away, and the next thing I know, it either sends back a friendly message to Bob, who's using the application, or it commits it successfully. And so it'll be interesting as people play with the beta to get their feedback on whether we did that did that well. But that's another example of, here's a best practice architecture that helps you figure out the right places to put your code, mm-hmm. Even if you don't know the right places to put your code. There's really kind of only one spot.
So one question I would ask is, I mean, that what you just talked about is certainly very important in a relational model, when that's your data model.
Right.
What about, you know, what people call NoSQL, which is a flat table, or Azure Table Storage, where you don't really have to have the cascading delete and the hardcore, sort of the constraints of the relational model, which is important for people who want durability and can ensure that things don't change, et cetera, but... You know, NoSQL is popular. So if somebody comes back to you and says, "Hey, I love this. Get the first two things out of my way, especially on the client. Mm-hmm. Really easy for my office, my little mm-hmm. dentist office, to do what they need to do. But I put my data in, say, an Amazon DB or something.
Right.
It's NoSQL. How do I work with this? Is that the entity level or?
It's still at the entity level. So because we took a to sort of normalize the model, we looked at the EDM and we said, how do they think about entities and entity relationships and, you know, how data looks.
Where EDM is, for those who don't know, the entity data model.
The one that's used by Entity Framework, and it's published on odata.org. Go check it out. So that's how we think about the data. Now, it ends up, if there's constraints on the data, relational constraints or validation constraints, those are, in effect, annotations or additional information. So if you have unconstrained data that's just a list, fine, it's unconstrained. You don't have to say, we're going to enforce this or this or that. In fact, sometimes that kind of enforcement happens on different tiers. So if it is a SQL database and we know that there's a relationship and SQL is doing the cascade delete and the foreign key management,
certainly.
Then we bring that into the system and we try to help you manage that. If your data actually doesn't have those things, there's nothing that says you can't work with it. It's just unconstrained. Now, if it's data that we don't know about, because we actually know natively how to talk to SharePoint data and to SQL Server, SQL Azure kind of data, you can go build a RIA domain service as a wrapper. This is one of the extensibility points that says, okay, how do I go expose some other kind of data to Lightswitch that we don't know about? And then what we do is we basically interpret the shape of the domain service. We infer an entity container from that. And then we actually wrap that domain service in yet another service. Because, in fact, because the domain service in that place is actually acting as a data access layer, it's not acting as a business logic layer, although it could have business logic, you still get to write business logic in front of it. And we translate that into a Lightswitch entity. You can still put validations on. You can still do what you want with it and then use it in the rest of our system.
Awesome. I mean, and that goes back to what you were saying earlier about you have your system people and you have your domain-specific people who don't need to understand how to build a domain service over WCF.
Right.
And WCF is kind of challenging for... that level of non-programmer.
Well, and you may see...
But that's awesome to know. I mean, that's very cool.
Well, and John mentioned this idea of bringing in external data. A common situation in this sort of system as well, we talked about just teams that are divided into systems and apps. But the fact of it is within a company, you'll sometimes get people who produce the hard data and the people who consume the hard data. Mm-hmm. And by hard data, I mean it may be hard to obtain, hard to track it quickly. I mean, can you imagine having to track the instant messaging traffic on the internet?
No.
All right. So, but there are people who do that, and then there's people who actually do metrics against them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the people who are doing metrics against them, they could attach to the net information, say, through Lightswitch, and that would be a great way for them to process it. Would they, within Lightswitch, have done the high-speed real-time data processing necessary to grab the metrics? You know, I don't think so. Mm. By the way, people who do that sort of data, they do NoSQL. They don't use SQL when they're doing tracking of messaging traffic. It doesn't provide features that are needed, mm-hmm. and it creates overhead mm-hmm. that would have been support of features that they don't need. Therefore, hey, let's get SQL out of the picture. Mm-hmm. And in fact,
let's get relational out of the picture.
Mm-hmm. Relational.
I mean,
yes,
I think
it's
unfortunate they named it NoSQL, and it's unfortunate that SQL is so tied to a product that we own. I mean, in some sense, it's the relational model. That's all. I just wanted to give that out.
Yeah, but what we're talking about is we're talking about data that's potentially just tabular, right?
Yeah.
There's no
in-memory.
In-memory. There's not necessarily any advanced processing or relationships described against it. And the core relational model, by the way, doesn't have those things. Let's be honest about that. Okay, so...
Cool.
I think there's probably one other example that would be worth touching on here. And I'm gonna hand this one over to John pretty quickly.
Uh-oh. I'll get my pen ready.
Get your pen ready. So we already pointed out the fact that we're using Silverlight and .NET. Any of our listeners who have been using Silverlight to attempt to do this sort of application knows there are certain complications in doing Silverlight for doing this sort of thing. One of them, for example, is Silverlight's network interaction is entirely async. And if you think about, the sort of person that we're trying to have be successful in this world, using async APIs is not a friendly place to start your development experience.
Sure.
And even if, okay, I've been writing software for 25 years. I don't like to do async, okay? If I could write a system where I didn't need to do async, that would be fine with me. If I needed to do async because I had no better way to do it, hey, that's fine. You know, I have the ability to do that. But if I can spend my time on other problems, that would be great. But you actually don't have a choice in the context of Silverlight. And there's a second challenge that's somewhat related to async, and that it's this question of... let's say that I wanted to do a call from the client to the service to get some information to handle updating my UI. Where do I block to wait for that? Well, if I do block to wait because I have an asynchronous system, that actually creates some interesting complications as well. And so this is one of the harder problems we had to work on, and I think we should tell you a little bit about that.
Do you want some bourbon first?
Yeah. This one could take a couple hours, so I don't know how much time we have. I'm going to try to... So Steve's kind of set up the problem is that you enter this world that says our primary goal is to give you a simple API to write your business logic. So you want to say something like order.customer.phoneNumber, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the way you've been thinking about your problem for years using other kinds of tools and languages. So breaking that up into a bunch of continuations or separate calls or something is difficult to even think about. To solve the problem, really, after we looked at lots of different angles, we talked to the Silverlight guys, we talked to the Real Services guys, you know, we talked to everybody about what could we do here. And in the end, what we thought to be the best solution really was to say, let's let the UI tier be the presentation tier. Let it run on the UI thread, and it doesn't process business logic. It just simply basically... shows the UI, it accepts user input, and all it ever does is really send messages back to what we call the logic thread. And so when you create a screen in LightSwitch, we actually create sort of two contexts. We create a logic thread context where the data workspace and the screen object, the models all go, and all the business logic gets executed. And then there's also the screen UI, the visual tree, and the pieces that do the data binding on that side.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had to do some complex gymnastics to bridge between the two, because they're effectively running asynchronous from one another. This isn't the kind of thing that, you know, mere mortals would go out to do in a typical day scratching out a business application. It's you'd avoid it at all costs, because it's really kind of a hard thing. So what we did with our runtime is we invented a model of business objects and a protocol for saying, how could we guarantee that from the perspective of the business logic and the perspective of the developer, that screen appears to be running single-threaded and non-reentrant. It's just running one line of code. It's like I'm processing a validator, I'm processing a command, I'm doing some work, I'm doing a query. And then integrate that with the UI such that they're getting updates and sending those things back to us. I don't know, do you want to describe the detail of the system or just the fact that we did it?
How about detail? Because of what you said is very... I understand what you just said, but we need another... Let's go a little bit farther
little
down
bit farther.
The rabbit hole.
I'll go a little bit farther and explain some of the concepts that we used to get it done.
Cool.
So... So we have these two execution contexts. They're really a logical thread of execution here and the UI thread of execution. And one of our rules on the UI thread is you can never block the UI thread.
Okay.
If you block the UI thread, Silverlight sort of is dead, the browser's dead. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of cases, if you block the UI thread, you can deadlock the application. So how do you not do that? And then over here, we want to have this line of execution that says I'm doing an ordered set of tasks that are asked by the application to run effectively linearized in that space. And then I have this object in between. We'll call this the customer object, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the customer object is, let's say this is the current activity here. It's getting acted upon here, but it's also being shown in some screen here where I have, let's say, you know, first name here, and it's data bound to customer.firstname. So what we ended up doing here was creating a class of business objects that we called dual-threaded objects.
Mm.
They were basically designed to say, I know about two threads. I know about my logic thread, because obviously there can be n different logic spaces running. And I know about the UI thread. And when the UI thread comes calling and asks for a value, I'll behave a certain way. When the UI data binding comes and puts a value, I'll behave a certain way. And then I know when the logic thread is calling, and then I know kind of who's calling and how I'm going to act. And so what we decided to do was the logic thread is the truth. The logic thread is always effectively your business logic. So whenever you ask the customer, what's your first name, if it's the logic thread that's asking, you're always going to get the truth, because mm-hmm. that's the synchronous world. If it's the UI that's asking, you're going to get whatever you happen to get. And the guarantee we make with the UI is that we're going to get you up to date as soon as we can, and we'll send you the change notifications as quickly as we can so that the UI will appear to be the most current state.
Okay.
Then what we do is, because you can imagine already if some of you smart people are thinking, okay, now I see all these issues, right? What happens when this guy's busy processing something and there's a bunch of updates pending and everything's out of whack? So we're working on that to solve that problem. To effectively order the logic queue so we can have prioritization. There are times, for example, when the UI wants to go load a list. And so, for example, there's some list. We're going to go asynchronously go fetch the data. When the data comes in and it alerts the application that it's going to come in, we just put it on the queue to be processed.
Mm.
We figure in some of those cases that's a lower priority event than the fact that you just typed Sally in as the first name.
Yes.
So that's a high priority UI event. So we put that up on the queue, we process it as quickly as we can get to it.
Mm.
And then we also handle states on the screen. For example, when we know that there's outstanding work to be done. So for example, you clicked a button here, we gray out the button immediately because we know that it's pending. We queue up the task over here to run on the logic thread to actually process the button handler, which isn't really a button handler, it's a command. You don't put code behind buttons in Lightswitch.
Cool.
We run the command over here, and then when it's done processing, we'll go ahead and re-enable the command, or at least run its, it has an actual business rule that says can execute. So we run the can execute and get it back up to state. So there's a lot of stuff going on back and forth between these two.
Mm.
It's fairly complex, and we're working hard to optimize that as well, so we don't have a lot of context switching, or as little as we can. And to make sure that Bob's experience here is very live. A nice thing that happens here, let's say with those computed properties, is you might have a grid where, let's say this thing is the total, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to load up a whole bunch of records. Well, according to this system, we have to go back to the logic thread to compute the total every time when it gets asked for. So we're optimizing that to where that can happen as quickly as possible, but wouldn't prevent you, for example, typing in the first name while we're doing that in the background.
So just to go back that a little bit, the UI thread informs the logic thread about sort of sequential operations. This one should happen before this one because the user informed the thread that run this combo box or fill this combo box
right.
while making this change. I'm sure your testers had a wonderful time testing this process, because I could see if you kind of had like an ADD experience on the UI thread where I click this, fill this list, no, do this one, not do this one.
Right.
And you're going to be sitting there trying to manage order of operations.
Right.
Well, the order of operations there is really a simple thing, right? We don't have a complicated algorithm of, you know, oh, combo boxes are more important than those things, right? It's really more about, there's just kind of two kinds of things that the UI is asking for. There's sure. active things where the end user actively did something. Sure. I hit a button, I typed a character, I selected an item on a list. Mm. And they want to have immediate feedback. There's other passive things the UI is doing, like computing these values to show up in the list. Those are passive things. You didn't ask for that. We're just going to do it. Mm-hmm. Refetching of, let's say that this list is bound to a query that's going to get reloaded at some point in time, and we're off waiting for that to happen. Mm-hmm. So, great. We'll go ahead and do that as a lower priority thing and process it sort of when we get to it. But we know that, you know, hitting the button or typing into the text box is a high priority. And those just get ordered, right? Mm-hmm. The order that you did them is the order they go in the queue and the order they'll get processed.
So now if I want to do my... One of the things that is probably the most popular feature that was of C-sharp and VB, of course, but let's start with C-sharp, link, gives you the ability to do querying over any type of data on the client.
Right.
It's a nice experience. So I might want to use a logic thread to do some link over whatever.
Right.
That's going to be, from my perspective, as somebody who designed the LightSwitch app, that gets priority. I want
right.
my queries to compute first.
So you won't be able to say, hey, this piece of business logic has higher priority than that piece of business logic, because your query might be running in a data validation, and depending on the passive data validation happens as you're doing data entry, active data validation happens when you hit save. And so we're just going to run it when we have to run it. And in the case where we hit save, everyone's waiting, right? Waiting for that, because it's going to happen.
Cool.
So we try to make that not be your problem. Mm. Now, you might find that there are certain cases where, you know, fetching that query all the time during a validation is actually not a very high-performance thing to do, and you'll want to move it elsewhere in the system. So we make it easy for you to write the code you want to write, but then you may have to do other things later.
And fundamentally, just one last question on the logic thread. I mean, we are in the age of, you know, concurrency hysteria, although it's definitely toned down in the past year. What if the logic thread is basically waiting on n number of other threads to compute over a large piece of data?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, does that...
So what will happen is, you know, this is just a single queue, right? And so anybody on the top of the queue can hold up the rest of the queue. That's life. Right.
Yeah.
So all we can possibly do for you there is to inform you, hey, guess what? Something's taking a long time. So this thread over here can actually observe the fact that this is taking a long time. We can put up some sort of notification that, you know, there's something pending, and help you to sort of, at least as an end user, realize that it's like the spinny beach ball problem. How do we let you know that something's taking a while? And so there's a lot of that stuff we're trying to just manage by default, so you didn't have to think about it.
Well, that's really the big deal, is that in this situation, if you understand enough to be able to work out coordinated threads and joining on them at the right time, mm-hmm. we're probably not solving a problem that you needed our help with, right?
Very likely.
But here's the thing. Most people don't even know what the constraints are of Silverlight at first. Mm. And if they attempted to do this, they'd create UI that locked up all the time. You know, mouse doesn't do anything. Browser turns white because I clicked on it. What's going on?
Sure.
This is an experience that they have all the time. And we tried to work around this and think, hey, is there any way we cannot deal with this gnarly thread management logic and these dual dispatch objects and things like that? And it's like, you know, no, we really need to solve this. Now, if you were a person who was writing this and wanted to have a very responsive application, you would do this manually. But what we did is we found a way that says, okay, the average Joe is going to be producing a pretty good experience every time out of the box with this.
Great.
Now, is it going to be as tuned and as perfect as somebody who's highly anal mm-hmm. would like it to be? Mm-hmm. Well, no, probably not. On the other hand, is LightSwitch going to be used for every one of those kinds of apps? Well, no, it's not. But the idea is that it is definitely built on an architecture that's been very well thought through against a set of best practices and to help people write their logic in the right sorts of places. I'm just going to touch on a couple more things, and then we can wrap up. John talked about commands. This is another example of where We said, what's the right place for you to put your business logic? One of the most evil places for you to put business logic is on an event handler. So we tried to say, how can we get rid of most event handlers that have any connection to user interface? Anybody who's ever had to convert a VB app to be multi-tier with business logic that runs somewhere other than the UI knows how vile it is to put their business logic in an event handler. But if you can put it someplace where it automatically switches tiers or runs in the right tiers, or you can encourage people to write the code at the right time in the right place, you've done a good thing. So that's a design point for us. We didn't really talk about this one, symmetric API. The fact is, let's say that I wanted to do access to OData, and in our case, in V1, the OData source that we support is SharePoint 14 or SharePoint 2010, I guess, is
yep.
SharePoint 14 being the code name.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll support SQL, and we'll support SQL Azure, and where SQL is any EDM provider, by the way. So we'll support these, and then I also mentioned that we've got this, or John mentioned that we can do a domain service, a RIA domain service, as a way of doing custom data sources. All right, now, if anybody who's ever written this code knows that the way that you write three of these four uses a different set of libraries. And if you, in fact, want to have data access code on the Silverlight, you're probably dealing with something different yet again.
Yep.
The problem is that we have people who are just saying data is data. Why do I care what source I'm accessing it from, whether it's running in Silverlight or .NET 4? Of course, the answer is they don't care. And it turns out that we thought that was a very high priority. And so we have one API for doing all of this. Now, we didn't create a new data stack. In fact, all we did is created a wafer thin, a veneer that sits over these and allows a consistent experience. And it also allows a consistent experience, for example, for how you can get at the metadata that describes, for example, your entity. An example of this is on a customer, I can dot and get at some details that describe all of the metadata that's stored in the model for that particular entity. And I also can get at a weakly typed API that doesn't care what type this is, that allows me to do interactions. And in fact, this is the mechanism that our runtime uses. Mm-hmm. So this is a case where model-centric stuff comes into play. And so this API actually does two things. One thing, it doesn't require you to learn these subtle variations. But the other thing is it actually provides substantial new value in terms of letting you get at this sort of information. And potentially, if you are a code jock and you want to be able to go in and extend LightSwitch in some interesting ways that we haven't anticipated, well, a lot of this metadata and a lot of the capabilities that our runtime uses is actually available to you as well, which is very nice.
One of the things I'll mention about that is that there's the detail API I just mentioned was one of the hard problems we needed to think about. How do I give you a simple data API that's just about the data, customer.firstname? It ends up that there's more data about first name than just the value. And a lot of it was hard to look at the existing data APIs out there that kind of took that into account, because when you build up your model, you have the storage data model, but you have a bunch of metastate about it. Is it currently read-only or not? Is it, what are the permissions related to that thing? What's the description or the display name I'm going to use for it? Is it dirty or clean? What's the actual dirty state? And does it have any broken rules for data validation? So there's all these questions you want to ask about a single piece of information, and I can't put that in a string. Like the first name is a string. So what we did is we just added that to the API, so where if you just said customer.firstname, you get the string. But if you go customer.details and then get to the first name property, then you can see all that other stuff. Hmm. And that's really what we use. When we drive the UI here, we're actually binding to that detail element. So we can actually bind all the UI via, the detail element there is kind of acting like a model/view model with all that information. And we can actually drive the UI directly from those model properties that get updated by the business logic.
Cool.
Very impressive. I think we accomplished what we wanted, came in here wanting to understand how this actually works and your thinking behind designing it.
Yep.
I think one thing that is crystal clear, at least in my opinion, and in your opinion, because you've stated explicitly, this is for people who don't want to spend time thinking about how to get something to actually function correctly outside of the scope that they're in, the domain that they're
right.
in. I want to update a database. I want to bring down a bunch of data, do some analysis on it, make some updates, send it back. That's all I want to do, and I want to design a form to do that, and we will make it unbelievably easy for them to do that, which is really cool. And you've given hooks for the people who are the systems people who might want to say, "Ah, we're not going against a structured database, man. I'm going to write this little service layer for you. We're going to pop that in. Don't worry about it." And the person will look at them not understanding it, go back to cleaning teeth or doing x-rays. This is good stuff.
Exactly. It's a constrained environment. It's the simplest way to write business applications on the desktop and in the cloud. And it runs inside of Visual Studio with extensibility, so you can really take it a lot further than a completely constrained environment normally would allow you to do. We open it up in a lot of really interesting ways. So,
beautiful. And the last question I would ask, because you have to leave with a question.
Okay.
It's Silverlight, and it's actually a good thing that it's Silverlight, because we're going to be releasing these things called phones that support Silverlight. Not Silverlight 4.0, I know that.
Yep.
But in the future.
Right.
Certainly would be nice to be a light switch app and say, actually, I want this to run on the phone. And then you have it generate the UI necessary for a smaller device. Mm-hmm. Rock and roll.
We agree. That would be really nice.
Right on. Take care, you guys.
Right.
Nice to meet you. Great work.
Thank you.